know if that kind of works.
So.
Okay, so next we have Andrew Raymond, and he's currently studying at Cardiff University.
Currently at Aberystwyth.
Oh, are you?
Yeah.
Sorry.
In the past I was at Cardiff.
Confused by it. And you've been looking at fantasy literature and ideology.
That's right.
Okay.
Yes, thank you. Thank you very much. Okay, first thing I'd like to say, this is my first ever conference presentation, so I am a virgin, so please be gentle with me, okay? also, I'm not going to do an overhead projector, I've just got the single handout, so I'm just going to speak, all right? Okay, so my paper is entitled The Manifestations of Belief in Our Time, a dialogue between Terry Pratchett and Slavoj Žižek. So essentially I'm going to talk about fantasy literature. My background is literature, so I'm really focusing from that angle. Okay, so fantasy literature, I think it's often dismissed in literary studies. But I think the fact that it's structured as real, and I call this the fantasy pragmatic course from the Greek, allows it to replicate the structures of our social experience, in other words, our reality. And thus, it can render it about us. Okay. Now, of course, this is fantasy literature, so a fantasy text must necessarily contain elements that are outside the realms of our social experience. And I call this the fantasy allos, again from the Greek. Okay, it just means the other, which is not real essentially. Now, the presence of, for example, fantastical beasts, shouldn't lead us automatically to dismiss fantasy literature as only for children or for adults who are kind of retarded in some way, and please don't think I'm some kind of retarded adult who haven't grown up or something like that, okay? Okay, so now the fantasy allos, it can certainly appeal to our wonder and invite us to take a kind of childish sense of delight in the imagination of the author. But I think it can also be a brilliant way to make us look again, at our real world, and not only to make us look again, but to actually make us look differently. Okay. So, for example, in fantasy text, the other or the outsider doesn't have to be, somebody from a different race or a different nationality. It can actually be someone from a different species. Fantasy text. Psychic realities, they don't have to be alluded to or demonstrated as they would be in a more realistic text, but they can actually get up and talk and jump and run. I'm thinking here of something like Philip Pullman's Demons, which are a kind of super ego manifestation. And fantasy texts also, time is not confined to the metaphorical, but in the fantasy text it can actually slow up or slow down, distort, and there's lots of examples in fantasy literature of this. A good example from Terry Pratchett is Thief of Time, but you can also think about Harry Potter and things like that. But perhaps above all and most importantly for our purposes here, fantasy can actually take something abstract and can manifest it, okay? At least it can manifest it in the real of the fantasy pragmatic course, okay? Because remember, the fantasy, in my interpretation of it, is structured as real. Okay, it has its own internal logic. So in this fantasy pragmatic course, something abstract can be manifested. Okay, and because of this, fantasy can be the conduit through which topics that they might be approached somewhat obliquely in realist literature, they can actually now be approached much more directly and rendered palpable. Okay, so this paper will try to exemplify how fantasy text can do this. In other words, take something abstract and manifest it. And I'll do this by looking at the very, very popular British fantasy writer, Terry Pratchett. Okay, I'm sure most of you have heard of Terry Pratchett. And I'm going to read him against what am I going to read? I'm going to read them again. Slavoj Žižek, part of his text in the 2006 book, How to Read Lacan. Okay, so the two Pratchett books I'm going to look at are firstly Small Gods, which is from 1992, and later Hogfather, which is from 1996. Okay, so I'll look at Small Gods first, and then read them against Žižek, and then I'll look at Hogfather and read that against Žižek as well. Okay, so start with Small Gods. Now, Small Gods is a text where an abstract notion, in other words, belief, is absolutely central to the text. Now, you know, many other texts can make a claim like this, you know, that the belief is central to it. But belief in Small Gods is not just an oblique part of the text, but it's actually a plot element that drives the narrative forward. And, you know, in the Small Gods is from the fantasy genre, and in the pragmatic course of the fantasy genre, belief is not just abstract, but it's something that's it actually physically manifests itself in the Discworld pragmatic course as a kind of nourishment. Okay, so you've got this idea of belief, and it actually nourishes gods. Okay, so people believe, and in this reality, because they believe, they create gods. Okay, so in this world, you know, belief is a kind of fuel for the gods. So you know, gods need believers, because if they don't have believers, they can't exist. If they have believers, they can grow and grow and become more powerful. If they lose believers, they become smaller and smaller and smaller. They can dwindle. They can die. Okay. So when we look back at the text, Small Gods, the small god of the title is the great god Om. Okay. And of course, the joke here is that he's not a great god, because he's lost nearly all of his believers, so he's been reduced to a tortoise. Okay, so he's the great god Om, who's actually a tortoise, and he's lost all his power. So you know, Pratchett is very funny, by the way. Okay, so you know, please laugh if I say something vaguely funny. So the fact that he has so few believers means he's been reduced to a tortoise, and this is despite the fact that he's in the in a kind of citadel, which is the center of the Omnian faith. Okay, so although he's in the center of Omnianism, he can only find one believer. Okay, so there's only one person who believes in him. That's why he can exist. If he loses this one believer, he'll die completely. Okay, so he's got his one believer, who's called Brother, who's a very simple novice. Okay, and he's the only person who truly believes in him. Okay, now, on the surface, you know, this is a situation which is quite surprising to the reader, because Pratchett presents the Church of Om as being in a situation, it's kind of in a situation of holy flux. Everybody's trying to be as holy as possible, because the Church of Om is awaiting a prophet. Okay, so you know, all these people trying to be as holy as possible. But what Pratchett actually does, he makes it clear that although everyone is seemingly trying to be holy, there are many in the citadel who they have the outward form of religion, but it's just become nothing more than a custom. Okay, so I'll give you a quotation here, if you'll forgive this. Forgive my pronunciation. Freet was trying to pray. He hadn't done so for a long time. Oh, of course, there had been the 8 compulsory prayers every day, but in the pit of the wretched night, he knew them for what they were, a habit, a time for thought perhaps, and a method of measuring time. Okay? So this kind of character is very common in Citadel. He goes through the outward forms of belief, and he goes through his prayers, but it's just become a habit. It's just become a custom. Okay. So this character, Freet, who I just quoted from, he exemplifies a shift from belief in the god to belief in the structure of worship, or belief in the structure of the church. Okay. So if you'll forgive another quotation. There's a character who's trying to explain this. Around the god, there forms a shell of prayers and ceremonies and buildings and priests and authority until at last the god dies. And this may not be noticed. There's a kind of shellfish that lives in the same way. It makes a bigger and bigger shell until it can't move around anymore, and so it dies. Okay? And this is, of course, what's happened Om. Okay? Everybody is worshipping the structure of the church. They're not worshipping Om himself, so Om has been reduced to one believer. Okay. Right, so this device in the text of making belief a kind of rocket fuel of the gods, I think this is a brilliant graphic tool because it, you know, it obviously suggests that it's humans that create gods, okay? And it also demonstrates that there may be a huge gap between the appearance of piety and actual piety as well, okay? And I also think, you know, the fact that worship may be empty worship of the shell of a religion is quite acutely observed as well, and dramatized in the Discworld Pragmatic Course by the fact that the god can actually die. Okay, so you know, if we accept this alternative reality is true, in that reality, you know, it brilliantly illustrates this point because the god can actually die. Okay, and you know, so you know, there's pause for reflection already, but you know, I think Pratchett is even more subtle than this. Okay, so we also have a third situation. So set against those for whom the form of worship has become the worship itself. There's also a character called Vorbis, who's a kind of fundamentalist. Okay, he's a fundamentalist, priest of Om. He's head of the Inquisition. He's incredibly brutal and incredibly feared. And also incredibly funny as well. Okay, you'll have to read the text anyway. Right? So, okay, now. It's obviously easy to contrast Brother, the man who really believes, against a character like Freet, who's the man who, for whom the form of worship has become worship itself. Okay, but it's much more difficult to contrast Brother against Vorbis, okay? Because Vorbis is not only head of the Inquisition, but he's, you know, he seems to be a character who really, really believes strongly as well. Okay. So the Vorbis character, you know, he believes so much that he thinks he can hear Om speaking to him in his head. Okay, so and you know, he acts as a kind of agent of God. He's a defender of Om against heresy and infidels and heretical ideas and that kind of thing. Okay, so you know, he's fighting against this on behalf of Om. And he also identifies himself as a kind of divine instrument as well. Okay, so I'll just give you another quotation about Vorbis. Okay, Vorbis always made a point of taking a walk through some of the lower levels, although, of course, always at a different time and via a different route. Insofar as Vorbis got any pleasure in life, at least in any way that could be recognized by a normal human being, it was in seeing the faces of humble members of the clergy as they rounded a corner and found themselves face to chin with Deacon Vorbis of the Inquisition. There was always that little intake of breath that indicated a guilty conscience. Vorbis liked to see properly guilty consciences. That was what consciences were for. Guilt was the grease in which the wheels of authority turned. Okay? So it's, yeah, it's quite funny, but you know, quite sinister at the same time. You know, so Vorbis, you know, he symbolically embodies the authority of the church stroke God, but so pure is his instrumentality that it's actually almost impossible to separate him, at least in his mind, from the God himself. Okay, you know, it's almost as if those who come across Vorbis in the corridors are actually coming across the God himself. All right. And, you know, to provoke a reaction, in other words, guilt, that simultaneously reinforces and provides a justification for the authority he embodies. Okay, so, you know, I see him as very much as a kind of pure instrument of the god. I mean, that's certainly how he sees himself. All right. So, you know, and you can also see another perverse reversal as well. Vorbis and the Inquisition, who he represents, are very closely identify with Om as agents of God in that they take on a kind of infallibility, a kind of divine infallibility. So the Quisition, it's another quotation here, the Quisition could act without the possibility of flaw. Suspicion was proof. How could it be anything else? The great God would not have seen fit to put the suspicion in the minds of his exquisitors unless it was right that it should be there. Okay, another, well, it's less funny maybe, but certainly a very, very sinister passage as well. Okay, so, I mean, this gives us a question, this provokes a question. Why is it Brother who is providing the fuel of belief to Om and not Vorbis? Okay, because we know from earlier in the text that Om has been reduced to the form of a tortoise because he only has one believer, but that one believer is not Vorbis, okay, it's Brother. So the question is why? Why is it Brother who's providing the fuel and not Vorbis, this fundamentalist, this man who, you know, kind of acts as a kind of divine instrument? He's closely identified with divine infallibility. Okay, so why Brother and not Vorbis? Okay, now if at this point I think we can turn to Žižek to perhaps provide a kind of explanation of why it's Brother and not Vorbis. Okay. Now, I think the first thing that we should note is that what we've actually seen about Vorbis means that he fulfills Žižek's description of a fundamentalist. And, you know, Žižek actually says someone who can be described as a fundamentalist is actually someone who's more accurately described as a pervert. Okay? It's not that funny, but okay. All right, I'll give you a quote from Žižek now, who, when he's giving his definition of a pervert. A pervert is not identified by the content of what he's doing, in other words, his weird sexual practices. Perversion at its most fundamental resides in the formal structure of how the pervert relates to truth and speech. The pervert claims direct access to some figure of the big other, a kind of Lacanian term, from God or history to the desire of his partner, so that dispelling all the ambiguity of language, he's able to act directly as the instrument of the big other's will. Okay? So, crucially, again, Žižek continues this, this claim to direct access, this claim to direct instrumentality, is a claim to knowledge. Okay? It's a claim to knowledge. I mean, this is fundamental, if you'll forgive the word, to what I'm trying to say. So, a fundamentalist pervert like Vorbis cannot believe in God because he knows he's acting for God. Okay, so his claim is to knowledge. All right. Now, I think this means, you know, what Pratchett has done in Small Gods is brilliantly illustrate the dimension of belief that's lacking in fundamentalism. Okay. The reason that Brother is providing the fuel of belief to the God is because Vorbis can't. Vorbis is a fundamentalist. He cannot believe. He can only know something. Okay. So a fundamentalist pervert like Vorbis can't believe in God because he knows he's acting for God. All right. Now, so I think what we can say, you know, in the real Discworld Pragmaticos, it's actually demonstrable that fundamentalists do not believe in God. All right, so I see Small Gods as a kind of a staging of this, or an illustration of this point of Žižek. All right. Now, in order to continue this kind of dialogue I've established between Žižek and Pratchett, it's a good idea to also continue to look at how Žižek continues his line of argument, the one that I mentioned before. And this time I'll compare what Žižek says with a later Pratchett text, in other words, Hogfather, which I mentioned at the beginning. Okay, now I think, you know, one thing we can say about Žižek is that, you know, the way he writes, he's always looking for a different angle, and he reaches kind of, you know, quite surprising conclusions quite a lot of the time. So I'll give you a quotation from Žižek now, which is a continuation of the one I gave before. It's a little bit long, but I think it's worth giving. Okay, so, Both liberal, sceptical cynics and fundamentalists share a basic underlying feature, the loss of the ability to believe in the proper sense of the term. What is unthinkable for them is the groundless decision that installs all authentic beliefs, a decision that cannot be based on the chain of reasonings or positive knowledge. Now, this is dangerous because in traditional secular humanism, the status of such values as human rights is that of pure belief. So something like human rights cannot be grounded in our knowledge of human nature. They can only be an axiom posited by our decision. So one is compelled to draw the paradoxical conclusion that in the opposition between traditional secular humanists and religious fundamentalists, it is the humanists who stand for belief, while the fundamentalists stand for knowledge. The true danger of fundamentalism is not in its threat to secular scientific knowledge, but in its threat to authentic belief. And maybe I should have given you that as a quotation anyway. Now, what I think about this, it's very much in the territory of Laclau and Mouffe, who talk about empty signifiers. I'll give you a quotation here from Michael Frieden. Empty signifiers which paper over the cracks in society to invent stability and system where no such things exist, where the clarion cry freedom produces the illusion that it exists and that a social order based on freedom is attainable. Okay. Now, Zizek seems to accept that signifiers such as freedom are empty, and he even suggests that, they might actually be seen as lies rather than just empty. But nevertheless, Zizek implies that it's dangerous to actually lose belief in such values. And I think this is a point which Pratchett seems to engage with in the text Hogfather. Okay, so I'll just give you a bit of background on Hogfather. Now, as in Small Gods, the narrative of Hogfather is driven by belief, or rather the idea of absence of belief. So Hogfather is a kind of piggy Father Christmas. Okay, he's like Father Christmas, except he looks like a pig. Actually, just don't think about that too much. I mean, just accept it. And in Hogfather, he's being assassinated by lack of belief. There are these kind of weird entities called the Auditors who've worked out a way to stop children believing in the Hogfather, and this is actually causing him to be assassinated because, as we've seen, belief is something which fuels the gods. So the Hogfather is something like a god. You might think of this as something like Disney, something like Nightmare Before Christmas or something like that. But Pratchett's treatment is actually a lot more kind of subtle than that, and it's a lot more profound than that as well, I think. The narrative drama of Hogfather is generated by, and here we can think of Zizek's idea again, it's generated by the real consequences that will result from a lack of belief. Okay, in Pratchett's terminology, if belief in the Hogfather is not restored, then, I'll quote here, the sun will not rise and humans will cease to be human. Okay, so again, I think we're going back to Zizek's idea here about the danger of a loss of belief. All right, so if you just look at the handout I've given you. Okay, now this is a dialogue from the end of the Hogfather. It's a dialogue between the two characters, Death and his granddaughter. And Death, the Hogfather's been saved, but Susan can't understand why it was so important to have restored belief in the Hogfather. Okay, so I'll just give you a moment to read that. Now, you have to remember, in Terry Pratchett, Death speaks in capital letters. Okay, I don't know why it's never been explained. He speaks in capital letters. Okay, make of that what you will. Okay, all right. Now, I think this extract is extraordinary. Actually, the claim that we need to believe in the little lies about Father Christmas in order to practice believing in the big lies, and here justice, mercy, duty, these are the big lies. And the first time I read this, I thought this was utterly outrageous. What a claim to make. But I think it only seems outrageous until you actually read it alongside Zizek. And the passage that I've just read about the loss of the humanist ability to believe. So, I see this as a kind of echoing, if you like, of Zizek's warning. Only it's, obviously a lot more apocalyptic. So I should have chosen an easier word to say there. A lot more apocalyptic. So, in other words, I think Pratchett is asking the question, why do we need to believe? His answer is kind of, because otherwise the sun will not rise. And I think Pratchett's achievement here is to structure a text wholly around the idea of a threat to authentic belief. Okay? And I think this is a structuring that's only possible because in the Fantasy Pragmatic course, belief is real. Okay? So I see these two things as absolutely vital, that they're closely connected with each other. Okay. All right, so I'll just sum up here. Hopefully I've demonstrated that a dialogue between Terry Pratchett and Zizek can be a fruitful one. I think both of these writers are quite easy to dismiss. Pratchett is a very comic writer. He's also writing in the fantasy genre. The fantasy genre, I think, is one which is very, very easily dismissed. And Zizek, make what you will of Zizek, but he's not always taken seriously, I think. It's often easy to miss how comic Zizek is as well. His prose is very dense and serious, at least in some of his earlier texts. And I think it's easy to miss the comic dimension there. So it's easy to miss things in both of these writers. And I think although they're seemingly coming from different directions, they both introduce very disconcerting ideas about the nature of belief, what it is to believe, why do we need to believe. And from the literary point of view, which is of course where I'm coming from, I think the main implication is that some fantasy literature at least, because obviously some is better than others, but some of it at least is capable of engaging with and interrogating serious ideas. And it's actually a medium through which unique angles can be taken to actually explore these ideas. Okay, all right, that's all. Thank you.
A very quick summary, I'd like to say. I mean, we're basically trying to say that fantasy does have a valuable function. It's an arena in which we can discuss and deal with issues at least as well as philosophy or more realist literature. Questions I have. You say that fantasy texts can make plain and render palpable abstract ideas, but what are the benefits of this? Why is it necessary to have such ideas, such as belief, tangible in order to think about them? Couldn't a realist novel do the same thing? Also, if showing abstract ideas as concrete is so important, why fantasy literature rather than film? What remains special for literature if this is the case? And lastly, if the issue is that fantasy literature can show what philosophy describes, why do you use Zizek as an example? What function does he fulfill? You said before it only seems outrageous when you read it next to Zizek. What then is Pratchett trying? What is he doing that is valuable without Zizek? So it's fine.
Just to answer the first of the questions, which was about fantasy literature and realist literature. Now, excuse me, I'm certainly not saying that realistic literature cannot deal with these issues. Obviously you can deal with belief and knowledge in a realist text, of course you can. But what I'm saying is that the fantasy, my concept of fantasy literature allows you to approach these issues in a different way from more realist literature, and possibly a way which is more, I don't know, it's just more direct, I suppose, is what I'm saying. Now, just like to refer to Todorov here, who I don't know if you know him, a structuralist from the 1970s or so. And Todorov's idea, Todorov's main contribution to literature was a book he wrote about what he called the fantastic. And I don't think the fantastic and fantasy, my concept of fantasy anyway, are exactly the same. But he's talking about some of the things which make literature fantastic. And it kind of refers back to almost what we were talking about before, about metamorphosis. Now, what Todorov says is that one of the things which the fantastic text allows is a kind of collapse. It allows a collapse between mind and matter. Okay. Now, you can take mind and matter in different ways, and I think Todorov is basically referring to metaphor again. He's talking about the way that in a fantastic text, the metaphor doesn't stay as language, but it actually collapses into the text and it becomes real within the fantastic text. And what he says about this collapse is that the collapse always results in an illumination. Okay, it always illuminates the gap that exists between mind and matter. All right, and I kind of think this applies here. What I'm talking about with Pratchett, the fact that belief in Small Gods and Hogfather it collapses into the Discworld real. I think that forces us to confront the nature of belief, what it is to believe, because it's just you have this idea of belief, and it's just ripped from its usual coordinates, and it's put into coordinates which are so different from how we normally see it. And I think we're confronted by what is belief if we see it in this utterly different context, where the context is just turned 180 degrees. Okay, so possibly just to kind of summarize the answer there. I think it's maybe the difference between showing something and saying something or explaining something. I think that's probably how I would explain it.
I felt it's a very simple point about that Greek word you used at the beginning, pragmaticos.
Pragmaticos, yeah.
But that's not a noun, so you can't use it. Fancy pragmaticos. It must be, and John can correct me here, but it should be fancy pragmaticos. It should be a noun.
Yeah, pragmaticos is an adjective, actually, yeah. But I can, because I sit within a tradition of linguistics where they take any word they like and they just use it however they want it. I think that's entirely my justification. it's just a shorthand for me, so I don't have to explain again and again what I mean, actually.
Yeah, but you're using it as reality, synonym for reality.
I'm using it as a synonym for real and reality. So
right.
I don't want to keep changing the form all the time.
Okay, no problem. And so the basic problem here is that you start this idea that the divine is realized only when people show attention to the divine. Like the god, for example, that's the Om. Was a god only because he had unbeliever?
Mm-hmm.
That's the idea we find, for example, in Heidegger, or in Miyazaki's films, that's the same idea. There should be some kind of community that realizes the divine,
mm-hmm.
that the divine to exist.
Mm-hmm.
And then you go on and describe the problem there, the connection between fantasies, belief, and the point. Like in the text we have in front of us, the problem is where you're saying that humans need fantasies to make life bearable. right? And then you're trying to systematize the relation there is between the belief mm-hmm. and the fantasies. Mm-hmm. And the problem is that if there's no established relation between the two, then what's the point?
Yeah, that's a good question.
So my problem with this notion of the fantasies, if that's the case, if the divine, if you identify the divine with the fantasies,
yeah.
I don't know if you do, but if you do, then they become the fantasies. Because the context in which they realize is just the very fact that they're real, and they're absolutely real, the divine.
Yeah. I think it's a very good point, and I think you have to, this is partly why I use the word pragmatic cause rather than the word fantasy, because I need to establish the difference between the genre and how it's used in a literary context and actually the word fantasy, which obviously has a whole load of other connotations as well. Yeah. So what you actually find in a lot of fantasy literature is when fantasy literature to me is about world building. The author has to build a world which is structured as real. Yeah. And if you build a world which is structured as real, you have to have fantasy in that world, because in a real world we have fantasy. Yeah? So part of what makes it convincing, part of what makes it a real world, is that it contains elements of fantasy in it. So you can have fantasy in the fantasy, if you see what I mean. Alright, if you're a character in a fantasy text, yeah, and you know, in your life, there's real and fantasy. Yeah, there's things which are real to you and things which are just fantasy to you. Okay, and you know, for me, if it was a realist novel, part of the way that the world is created is to do with things which are real to you and maybe things which are not real to you, which are fantasy to you. Okay, well, it's the same in a fantasy text. I mean, you know, if I have a character in a fantasy text, he's real in the fantasy text. And he's real in the real of the fantasy text, but there's also another fantasy as well. Yeah? And part of the way the world is constructed is by the constructing of fantasies in fantasies as well.
So where's the pleasant and divine?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think I actually mentioned the divine. I mean, it's in terms of the way the text works, the function of the text, belief is a kind of device, I suppose. It's a device in the text for the creation of gods. Okay, in Pratchett's Discworld, gods can only exist if people believe in them, and there's a kind of physical thing. Yeah, it's a physical thing, it's not abstract. You know, I mean, the normal notion of belief is that something quite abstract. It's not something physical, it's not something you can touch, it's something you can feel. Okay, whereas in Pratchett, it is. It's rocket fuel, that's how he actually describes it. Okay. So you know, I think the question is, you know, how much you can actually relate the fantasy text to the real world, because if you can't relate it to the real world, then it becomes pretty irrelevant. It just becomes pure entertainment. Okay? So part of my argument is that the fact that the fantasy is structured as real actually allows you to make connections between the two things. Okay? So I mean, I see this as a kind of illustration. You know, I'm reluctant to actually talk about philosophy directly because this is literature. So it, you know, the way he engages with it is through the medium of literature, and specifically through the medium of his constructed world. So I'm a bit reluctant to say, well, it means this or it doesn't mean that, because it's so grounded in the text.
Okay, so just probably you're bringing out the philosophical
program
this way.
I'm not a philosopher. I'm
right. So.
Okay. I'm interested in the way that you brought up the way that this type of fantasy literature, and I don't think it will work for all of what we call fantasy literature, might be seen as replicating structures of our experience in concrete fashion, which enables us to foreground elements in our experience one might not foreground, and thereby see the world differently. I think you brought out very well the way that way that in this world this happens. And I think and it's a good question that was asked, what exactly is the function of Zizek if you push that line far enough? But let's consider them together. Because it does strike me, as it struck you, that there are very interesting convergences here. And what I want to push you on, both or either with respect to the fantasy or with respect to the Zizek, is the relation between belief and fundamentalism. Now, as we're presented with both your authors, fundamentalism is integrally related to knowledge. But in Zizek, it's a particular relation to knowledge. It's a knowledge which may be described as a form of perversity, in which the one who has knowledge relates in certain ways to the big other being seen as dominant. Now, I'm not clear how this maps onto the notion of knowledge, the idea presumably being that knowledge is other than oneself, and that is something which I have grasped hold of, and so the structure of one's relationship to knowledge is that in which you are always in a subordinate position, and take it that far. And the contrast with belief is that, again, as you said, belief is grounded in decision. There seems to be certain echoes of an existentialist tradition going on here. It's a form of belief which, where you make your own and recognize that in a certain sense it is your own, whereas your grand inquisitor has made the knowledge his own, but without recognizing that it is his own, I think.
Yeah.
So, I suppose the question that I want to ask is, how convincing in terms of the structures of our experience is this bifurcation between knowledge, which is apparently construed, as I've just been describing, and the terms used are fundamentalist and perverse, and belief, where belief is grounded in the notion of decision that we recognize as our own decision. And the paradoxicality of that in terms of our own experience comes out in that passage you put on your handout, whereas Susan doesn't seem to think that justice and mercy whatever the other one is. Are just functions of decision until death tries to help her to see the analogy. So it seems to me, yes, this is a nice way of construing the structures of our experience. To what extent do you think that this is revelatory of them or attempting to twist them in certain way to make a good story?
Yeah, I think that the last point is certainly relevant. I think the starting point for that discussion would probably have to be it's almost an inadequacy in the language, because knowledge in English, I mean, you take French for example, the difference between connaître and savoir.
Yeah.
The claim which Vorbis, the fundamentalist, is making is definitely a claim to connaître. Yeah, it's a claim to some kind of absolute knowledge. So, you know, obviously because the text is written in English, this doesn't come out clearly. So I think that would probably be my starting point for that actual discussion. Mm-hmm. How much is a good story? Yeah, I think the starting point with Pratchett, and probably the starting point for all fantasy literature, is the story. It has to be narrative driven. It just has to be. I mean, it's bound up in the genre, because it's part of people's expectations of the genre. You know, you expect to read, you know, a kind of page turner, if you like, something like that. So obviously Pratchett's starting point is a good story, but you know, because of the way that fantasy is structured, and it goes back to the point you originally made, because it's structured as real. You know, we can accept that when the text is talking about belief and knowledge, that these are terms that we can relate to, you know, even if they're decontextualized. And
Yeah, it doesn't really come out so much in these two texts, but you know, I see fantasy literature as part of this kind of, it's why, going back to Charles' question, it's why I actually twinned him with Žižek, because I think, you know, Žižek's idea of an intellectual is somebody who kind of questions the accepted, or questions the familiar, and who, you know, questions what is self-evident. And I think that's how Žižek really sees himself as a philosopher. I can't speak for him, obviously, but he's kind of in this, you know, Foucauldian tradition as well, of an intellectual who doesn't tell you what to do. He's just provocative. He just wants to make you think about things. And I think, you know, you see very much the same thing in Pratchett. Pratchett takes ideas and he just twists it around so that you can actually look at it from a completely different point of view. And, you know, I very much hesitate to actually say, you know, Pratchett is telling us this or something like that. But, you know, he's presenting us with something which is extremely provocative and which you can't ignore. You just can't ignore it in the text because it's, you know, it's part of the structure of the text, which is kind of what I was trying to show.
Okay, I think we've got time for just two quick questions.
I kind of lost track of what I wanted to ask. I suppose it's something about the sort of the real consequences of a lack of belief. I guess I'm wondering how sort of how cynical a vision this is. I mean, in that, okay, so we've made beliefs real in a way, but now maybe we don't understand what they're for. I mean, they're nourishing, but are they nourishing us or nourishing something else? And if they lose this grounding, I mean, if we're looking at them as having, as not ever having grounding, what, so, I mean, because it sounds as though, I haven't read the Pratchett, but it sounds sort of like it's kind of urging us to recognize the value of true belief, but is it also, you know, making it seem, well, that's just for, you know, that's not something we could have, and have it in a reflective
way. I think Pratchett is probably the most cynical writer I've ever read in existence. I think that's an interesting question because Žižek's response, I think, would be that it's a necessary fantasy, yeah. And you know, whether you know if you believe in a fantasy, I mean, if you believe in something that he posits as a fantasy, so if you believe in things like justice and human rights, the value is that by accepting these beliefs, you're not confronted with what's behind the belief, and what's behind the belief is far more terrifying and far more awful than just accepting this belief that actually isn't real. So I think they are very cynical. They are very cynical, but you know, I don't think I can provide you with any hope from that point of view. But you know, again, I would hesitate to actually say Pratchett is saying this. You know, I think his starting point is trying to make you, confronting you with something that you can't ignore, maybe with something that you haven't looked at from that point of view before. And again, I don't think neither of them is ever saying you should do this. You know. Žižek's, you know, position is almost you can't do anything at all. There's nothing you can do. These are just necessary things that we need, and you know the fact that they're not real, it shouldn't mean that we should stop believing them. Because if we stop believing them, then what on earth do you do? What's the point? As Susan said.
Any final question?
Yeah, and I think it's related to earlier questions. So I guess one of the reasons I find it difficult to learn much, although I enjoy fantasy fiction, learn much from it, is it's very difficult to see where we're to draw the line within the fiction between the bits that are supposed to be imported from reality and the bits that we're just supposed to go along with as part of the fantasy. And this comes up in striking form in the handout, where we're presented with an argument by Death that strikes me as an appalling argument. The kind of argument we set up in first years, you know, then it's not clear to me where whether this is supposed to be a good argument within fiction, so whether these would be decisive considerations within this world, or whether they're supposed to be decisive considerations more widely, we're supposed to be convinced by that here. So I just wonder what we're supposed to make of this kind of presentation of, for example, logic within a, within a fantasy context.
Yeah, it's a, that's another good question. I think I would answer that by first of all saying that you mentioned that it's a kind of argument for first years to knock down, but you have to remember, you know, Discworld is not read by philosophy students most of the time. You know, it's one of the most popular, you know, series of books ever. So, you know, I don't think Pratchett's writing for, you know, philosophy students or even any particular audience, in fact. Again, I would hesitate to actually say that we're meant to that we're actually meant to take death's position. You know, I don't think Pratchett ever preaches. You know, he's not writing to say you should think this. He's just presenting you with it, and it's you know, it's part of it. The way he operates as a writer is to, you know, it might be a weak argument. I don't know. That's not really a question for me, but it's certainly something which people have never thought about before, even. And most people, I guess I hesitate to use the word people, but you know. But you know, I think, you know, most people. I'm just doing it again. All right, start with something like human rights or whatever. You know, people just automatically think that's a good thing, and you know, what we think about human rights is probably not grounded in knowledge, our knowledge of what people do in the world. So you know, I think Pratchett is deliberately trying to be provocative. Actually, he's just deliberately presenting you with something which you just go, wow, when you read it. I mean, if you've never considered it from that angle before. Just to answer the previous point, you know, part of the problem with fantasy, I think, in terms of discussing it, is that as a genre, it's not very well defined. So, you know, you get lots of books which have the word fantasy in the title, and then they're written about, you know, they're kind of all inclusive. You have kind of science fiction, you have the gothic, you have ghost stories. So what I'm trying to do in my dissertation is just narrow it down. Obviously, I'm not trying to claim this is fantasy, but it's the way I talk about fantasy. And to me, fantasy has to be structured as real. It has to be something which has its own internal logic, and which is kind of world building, you know, like children do something like that. So I think in that kind of text, obviously not all of them do this, but that kind of text allows you a kind of entry and a kind of points, kind of nodal points of comparison with the real world. Because, you know, if you've got something like a ghost story, this goes back to Todorov again, he would say that's fantastic, and his argument would be that the fantastic is this kind of gap, this gap between whether it's real or whether it's not real, and you're kind of undecided, you hesitate. You know? Whereas fantasy literature, the fantasy I'm talking about, it's not modal at all. There's no modality in it. It's meant to be taken as real, so you actually have to accept it on two levels. You have to accept it as obviously not real, but then you have to accept it as real on its own terms. And if you have that kind of structure, I think it's a good way to look at things like, you know, racism. Pratchett, some of Pratchett's books are about racism, and they're clearly about racism. I mean, it is very clearly foregrounded in the text. So you are very, very clearly meant to relate it to real things.
Thank you very much, Andrew.
Question, slush. Well done.